So John Taylor in the seminar room with the theme this morning, living water, fonts, wells, and deserts. I thought out that sequence of ideas that bring us from the water of baptism, the water that cleanses and also unites us in the Christian family, going on then to the water that we need in the world and that we need to share in the world, the need that we have to draw water from wells, but behind that maybe even the need to drill wells. Good to find that Holden is engaged in financing the drilling of a well in Namibia. But having thought about this living water that obviously conjures up the story of Jesus with the Samaritan woman, I then couldn't help but remember the great parts of the world that are desert, that are spiritually desert and physically desert. And certainly trekking up the path, the cloudy pass yesterday, the long stretches where there was no water at all, reminded me of what it's like to be in a desert. And then going through my papers, I discovered this rather nice cartoon, which I'll pass around, which was one of the designs that didn't make it for the cover of the closing worship at Vancouver. Anybody who's listening on tape, I better describe the cartoon. It starts with the worship tent of the assembly up in the corner. And it looks as if there's been some sort of fire alarm, because the worshippers have rushed out of the tent and are lining up and passing buckets of water from hand to hand. So it seemed to me that this, in a way, fitted the theme that I'd chosen for this morning, that the water that we have in our worship, the water of baptism, the living water that we receive from our Lord Jesus, then has to be carried out into the world, maybe bucket by bucket. And it's a human chain where the people are passing from hand to hand the heavy buckets of water. There isn't actually a well illustrated in the cartoon, but we can imagine maybe that there was a well somewhere from which the water supply was coming. But the end of the chain is not in fact a fire. The end of the chain is a parched desert. And in the parched desert, there is a sprout growing. And I think that that's what many of us would like to see as coming out of Vancouver. I'll pass the cartoon around. One of the things we said at the end of the last General Assembly, which I remind you was in Nairobi in 1975, was that as Christians we must be ready to be a pilgrim people. And like Abraham, we must be ready to go out into deserts, ready to go, knowing not where we were going. And I think that that has been the experience of those years between the Nairobi Assembly and the Vancouver Assembly. I'm holding up now the official report of the Nairobi to Vancouver activities of the World Council of Churches, which, I remind you, are not just the activities of a staff in Geneva, but the activities of the member churches around the world. And in many ways it has been a desert period. It's been a difficult period. We've heard repeated again at Holden this week the reminders of the way in which poverty has got worse, wars have multiplied, infant mortality has increased. All the dreams that we'd had in previous decades of cracking some of these problems have withered, and we felt ourselves very often as a pilgrim people, parched with thirst in the desert, and yet, as we saw last night in the forum, daring to hope. And now there's a question as to whether we've been able to plant a seedling in that desert. So this morning I want to come through the sequence of different styles of ecumenical activity, all of which I think are equally important. Very often we get the question put to us, you know, what is the purpose of the World Council of Churches? And quite clearly, we want to reaffirm the importance of that bringing together of the churches in one, obedient to the prayer of Jesus, that we should be one, that the world may believe. And that quite clearly brings us into this area of the sacraments of the church, the points where the churches are together, but also where the points where the churches are divided. And that's why, in thinking about living water, I started off with this focus on the idea of the font, the place where the water of baptism is offered. I'm not a theologian, I'm a layman, and I can't go into the details of the dogmatic significance and the liturgical significance of the water of baptism. But for me, it's a very simple sign of God's free gift of grace, God's cleansing gift of grace. It seems to me that whether we think of baptism as a rite that is celebrated with a newborn child, or whether we think of it as a celebration of an adult's deliberate plunge into faith and choice of faith, we are celebrating above all not a human choice or a human dispensation, but we are celebrating the way in which God is ahead of us, that God is making provision for us, the Creator God, the Redeeming God, the Sustaining God. And especially, I think, especially obvious in a sacrament of infant baptism is this idea of totally undeserved, unmerited, even unacknowledged grace. The water of baptism there, not cleansing in a primitive or superstitious sense, not to be understood, as I see it, as washing away an original sin, not allowing a sacrament like that to be used to paint a picture of humanity inherently vile and bound to perdition unless the water of baptism is applied in a sort of miracle formula. But much more, a celebration by Christians of the way that even though from birth we're born into a world where we're victims of human weakness, where we inherit genetically very often human weakness, where we are also inheritors of a great deal of human privilege and beauty and ability, that in that ambiguous human nature that we all inherit, there is this gift of God's cleansing and sustaining love that we symbolize with the water of baptism. Now, when we come very specifically to the task of the ecumenical movement, we start, I think, quite rightly with this main purpose of the ecumenical movement, that the churches should come together, grow together, stay together, whatever word we use. And then, as we said very strongly at Vancouver, that we should learn to live together. And that we should learn to live together because we have in common, as Christians, celebrated this gift of life, that we have all of us been washed in this living water. There has been, as you've heard, a whole series of very patient theological conversations going on over the years through the Orthodox churches, through the member Protestant churches as well of the World Council, but also extending very significantly to the Roman Catholic Church. And there has come out of this what has been called not a consensus, because that maybe would be running before we could walk, but there has become a very clear sense of convergence, that we are walking together towards a common understanding of some of the central bases of our Christian faith. And we have symbolized that, if you like, in these sacraments of baptism and Eucharist, and also of order of ministries. So I'd like to talk just for a little bit to begin with this morning, and then we'll pause and see if we've got any questions about that. First, about this basic thrust for Christian unity in terms of trying to come to a common understanding of some of these great common features of our Christian faith. Baptism, for example, is something that is practiced in pretty well all the constituent body of the Holy Catholic Church, the whole ecumenical movement. We have to remember there are a few exceptions. There are Quaker friends, for example, members of the Society of Friends, who feel that any sort of symbolic representation is unnecessary, and they would certainly meditate on the significance of the water of baptism, and they would claim, just as much as we would, the need to have the cleansing grace of Jesus Christ. And they would, just as a personal choice, perhaps dispense with baptism. Let's not forget, too, that there are Christians, sometimes called secret Christians, in parts of the world, who, for one reason or another, have not been baptized. And I don't believe that it is for us to pass judgment on why they've not been baptized. It may be that they have grown up in a society where baptism has been understood in a superstitious, primitive way. And it's almost become a stumbling block to think that you have to go through this sort of cleansing process to be accepted by God. And for some of them, there will be a very clear sense of being accepted by God. And maybe for personal reasons that we don't necessarily want to justify dogmatically, but at least we have to live and let live, there are some people who have not been baptized, and yet who are part of a worshipping community, and maybe even of a Eucharistic community, because some churches will indeed receive into Eucharistic fellowship people who are not baptized, but who love the Lord Jesus. There are those too, and we shouldn't minimize this, who perhaps have grown up in a Hindu culture, or a Jewish culture, or a Muslim culture, and who see Christian baptism, the way it's been described to them at least, as a way of turning their backs on their own fellowship, their own family loyalties, their own community loyalties. And maybe precisely because they want to be witnesses of Jesus Christ in a Muslim village or in a Jewish family, they say, if we are baptized, particularly if we have public baptism, we know we shall be driven away. We shall no longer be witnesses. And for them, there may be a painful decision of deferring baptism, maybe until others in their family or others in their village are ready to join them, so that baptism doesn't become then an individual sacrament, but it can become a communal sacrament. I don't think we should legislate about baptism. And this has been one of the breakthroughs, I think, in the whole World Council study process, both on baptism and on Eucharist and on ministry. That instead of passing judgment rapidly on the different ways in which different churches understand baptism, instead of passing judgment on the Baptist churches for deferring baptism until a moment of adult choice, or passing judgment upon the anonymous Christians, or passing judgment on people who practice infant baptism, we learn a respect for each other's different ways. Similarly, when it comes to understandings of the Eucharist, we know that there's still a long way to go. The World Council documents that came out of Vancouver are not documents of self-congratulation about how marvellous it is that we've done this. They're documents that still state the pain and struggle. Listen to this. Confronted with this convergence text on baptism, Eucharist and ministry, we're called to express in what measure we can recognize together the same apostolic faith. The document invites our churches to make the journey from isolated identities towards fuller fellowship. We receive the invitation with real excitement, but also with a realization that despite its achievements, the document on baptism, Eucharist and ministry falls short of convergence even on some important issues. The pain which this causes must be felt on our journey. So it isn't just a great glorious euphoria that the churches are all automatically and inexorably being sucked into some sort of easy unity. It's going to be a painful pilgrimage if we go on honouring those differences, understanding those differences. The same is true of our understanding of Eucharist and ministry. But there's a quotation here that I'd like to read as well before turning to you and seeing whether you have any special questions on this. A quotation that is based very much on texts in the letter to the Romans, the letter to Galatians, and the first letter of Peter. As we grow in the Christian life of faith, baptized believers demonstrate that humanity can be regenerated and liberated. Likewise, they acknowledge that baptism, as a baptism into Christ's death, has ethical implications which not only call for personal sanctification, but motivate Christians to strive for the realization of the will of God in all realms of life. And that's the springboard to what I want to say later this morning, that even as we converge together, even as we struggle together to realize the thirst-quenching potential of our worship life, of our fellowship in Christ, that isn't just to quench our thirst within the Christian family. It's to help us to go and quench other people's thirst. It's to help us to see the ethical implications of what it means to be a Christian. That if we are receiving the water, receiving the bread, receiving the nourishment of the Christian family, it's not just that we stay together in rosy health amongst ourselves. It's to equip us, not just for personal sanctification, but so that we can realize the will of God, so that we can be servants of God out in the world, and so that we can start taking our buckets of water out to water the deserts. Now, let me pause there and ask whether any of you would like to push a bit further on some of these issues of church order, what the World Council is doing, or what you in your churches can be doing to improve the situation of barriers set up in the name of dogma, where we have made dogma into a cause for division instead of using dogma as a cause for growing together and uniting together, both amongst ourselves as Christians and with the world. My guess is that the whole area of this theological work to enhance the unity of the church is one where we've maybe in the past done a bad job from the World Council of Churches, and that people haven't realized the very solid achievements that have been made in this area. But the moment has come now for those solid achievements to be taken through to the local level? Maybe you have some ideas on this or some questions on this. Yes, Arnold.
I'd like to comment, this is the GR1, isn't it?
Yes, this is GR2, actually.
GR2, yeah. When you read the part upon the ethical consequences of our baptism and when we take Eucharist together, that we receive freely the grace of God. I remember this passage because I was so happy and so glad when this was read. Because this is one of the points that I always come back, that and I go back again to my transnationals. But the transnational companies in the developing countries, in the third world countries, they are using corruption because our governments have no ethical content. So this goes very much together. They are not acting like Christians. And this makes me so very happy. Now about the BEM. In our church we have been discussing the Evangelical Church of Lutheran Confession in Brazil. We have been discussing the consequences that were pointed out about baptism. When you baptize infants, then you accept them and you offer these children to God that they may have a Christ, a Christian life. You give your children, so to say, to God. But then they are also able to take part in the Eucharist, because these two sacraments go together. They were given us by our Lord. And this created a lot of discussions. And something that five years ago, nobody would think about this. And all of a sudden we are thinking about it, and not only thinking about it. Many of the pastors of our churches are already giving Eucharist, the Holy. We don't call it Eucharist, we say Holy Supper, giving it to children. And something else, we have a retarded daughter, she's 27, and till some 5-6 years ago, well, we wouldn't dare to bring her to the Eucharist because she is very much retarded. But then we were taking Eucharist and she was sitting there. And one day I went along to church with her, my wife couldn't come. And so I took her also with the Eucharist and she was so happy. And from then onwards we are giving, she participates. And we were discussing this in Vancouver in the small group. And then the Orthodox said that in their church this is part. The most important sacrament is baptism. And for them, confirmation is also a sacrament. But that you are baptized, you can get the Eucharist. And speaking here and there, there was a pastor from Belgium. He said that in his congregation appeared a family. They were not of his evangelical church. It's called the Evangelical Church in Belgium, I think. And these were former Darbists of the Plymouth Brethren, who, as far as I could understand, I don't know it exactly, baptized only adults. And they had a retarded daughter as we have. And they wouldn't have baptized her because they said, you cannot understand what's going on and so forth, so forth. So you have no right to be baptized and cannot get Eucharist. Well, the same many of pastors in our church do not give Eucharist to children because they say, Jesus also prepared his disciples before giving them the Holy Supper. And you know, these are always tensions. And then this girl wanted so much to participate in the Eucharist, so he gave Eucharist to her. He gave Eucharist. And after half a year, the girl said, I want baptized. She wanted to be baptized. And so he asked her parents if they would agree, because after all they were Plymouth Brethren. And so he baptized the girl. But this was something, I tell you, I was goose-skinned from up to down. This is something marvelous. That people who call themselves Christians, and they do not accept that these retarded people, they are children of God. They are made in the image of God, as all we others are. And this is a breakthrough. You cannot imagine how this is a breakthrough that is coming in the churches. This question of you baptize a child, then you will have to draw the consequences. And not put the barrier of confirmation and all this that we are accustomed over centuries. This is a great breakthrough for all our churches.
I think this points to one of the major shifts in emphasis that the ecumenical movement has brought, that instead of churches understanding their role as creating barriers and excluding and defining and very often judging, we're beginning to learn that our basic calling, although we are out of the world, is to be sent into the world. Therefore, our basic calling is to break down barriers. Our basic calling is to include people, to draw them in, but to draw them in by going to where they are. And that can include children. It can include, and it must include children. Jesus himself put the priority for children. And if we think of people with mental disabilities as, in many ways, par excellence,
children,
innocent, unable to take choices of their own, but nevertheless able to respond, because that's the marvelous thing about children.
Love, they are love.
That from a tiny infant, a child is able to receive, and a child is able to respond. And there, I think, we've sometimes got things wrong in our churches. That we have seen, I'm anticipating my second point, but I'll come back in a minute. We've seen this impetus to give. We've seen this impetus to do things. But we haven't always had the ability and the grace to receive. And that's, I think, what these basic sacraments are all about. The ability to receive the water. Very interesting, too, that sort of turning point in Jesus' ministry. This is once again using the imagery of bread, when Jesus describes himself as the bread of life and offers himself and then asks people to receive the bread. The gospel writer says, and then many people turned away.
They could not.
Because people sometimes find it almost harder to receive. The older we grow, the more responsible we are, the more dynamic we are, the more outgoing we are, and so on, the harder it is to have the grace to receive. Children have that grace. And it's these sacraments of receiving the water of baptism, passively, of receiving the body and blood, in a sense passively, that I think are a clue to our discipleship. Yes, Nyla?
I fear, though, sometimes that the baptism gets really tied up with magical things. And when I was separated from the community of faith, I work in a big medical center, and I'm working with newborn babies who are very tiny, and many will not live. And it's people in Washington, D.C. are very separated from their home churches, and don't go to church very much. But many have grown up with a faith. And then it's like when they have their child, they don't know what to do. And if their child isn't going to live, they know somehow that they want their child baptized, but it's almost like this magical little sentence needs to be said over their child before their child dies. And I don't know how to work that.
Personally, I'm not too worried about that, because I think that, you know, in this moment of extreme stress, you can't really come to terms with suffering with clever ideas or clever explanations. Mm-hmm. You need a symbol to break through. And if the symbol is simply that even a deformed, dying child is accepted and loved, and even this imperfect creature apparently has the seed of perfection because of what Christ has done, then I think that for all the sort of theological grey areas around it, I'm prepared to sort of even to buy into superstition, because superstition can be saved, superstition can be redeemed.
What I find exciting about the document is that I was at an ecumenical dinner just last week, or so a couple weeks ago, and they pointed out that a lot of these discussions on baptism, Eucharist, and ministry, what's different is that rather than what we've done in the past, like you said, concentrating on our differences and this is the Lutheran dogma and this is the Roman Catholic Church and this is where we don't agree, so somehow we've got to change those things so that we agree with each other. Rather than approaching it from that standpoint of changing to agree, we've approached it starting with, well, where do we agree? What are the commonalities?
Convergence.
Convergence. That difference, that's all the difference in the world, because we all start with Christ. And that's the basis of our faith, is what Christ has done for us.
Until we build the barriers.
Yes.
Sure. I mean, the point is, we just got to go back and try to see these things through the eyes of what Jesus would do. Now, he doesn't have any problem with the retarded person. At least the Jesus of love that I know doesn't have any problem communicating or celebrating.
He's as perfect as any others.
No way.
Yes.
And why we set up these false barriers, to me false, I don't know.
It's about time.
And that's
we
a man creation.
Ignoring them.
I don't think it's Jesus.
But could I give a contribution here to Lyra?
Mm-hmm.
I am a person who was baptized in. In German, you say Nottaufe. I don't know what's the name in English.
Emergency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was 6 weeks mm-hmm. old, and I had a diarrhea, which in those times in the interior small town in Brazil where I was born was just the same as a death certificate. And as a matter of fact, the neighbors were already, the women, neighbors of my family, my parents were already in the room, you know, waiting there for the kid to die. Mm-hmm. And then my mother, in her desperation, said, "We have to baptize the child. He cannot be interred without being having a name, a Christian name. He must have a Christian name." And my father chose my name, Arno, because he had an employee, and he said, "Arno was always so very easy to call, you know." "Arno, come here, Arno." So, and all of a sudden it happened that I didn't die, you know. If this is superstition, if this is a miracle, or if this is a way of God,
sure.
I don't know.
It'd be nice to go on talking about this, but I think we should just try and keep faith with ourselves and say, now, what does it mean if we have this water of baptism, if we have this living water given to us, a symbol, of course, not a magic washing, but something that is reminding us through our lives as Christians of the God who's gone before us and the God who stays with us and the God who goes with everybody, regardless of their abilities. What does that say to us about, you know, really following through these ethical implications of what it means? And that's where we come to the image of the well. Just the other evening, Jean talked very beautifully to us about the way in which the symbol of the well was being used at the assembly as a place from which we could draw water and draw resources and refreshment and so on. And also remember the encounter of Jesus with the woman of another faith at the well, the woman with the sinful life according to the moral standards of her day and so on, and yet who nevertheless Jesus could accept. And yet wells are also ambiguous. One of the things that you may remember from the International Year of Women a few years ago was that they took this slogan, "Water for Women." And you see it's still with us because there's still this desire to bring water within easy reach of every home. And yet it's an ever more difficult prospect to fulfill as populations arise and increase, especially in underprivileged areas of the world. And both digging a well and drawing water from a well is a harsh, harsh process. I can think of a leper colony in Tanzania where the lepers have to go nearly 2 miles to get their water. And some of them go on stumps, and some of them may have feet that work, but when it comes to drawing up the water, they're drawing the the rope on their forearms or what little is left of their hands. And when you've got the precious water up, maybe as a small child you have to carry this brimming bucket back, and the water spills and splashes, and although you've started with a heavy burden, such a lot of it is wasted getting back. Wells are not just idyllic items in the decoration of an oasis. Wells are necessities which remind us of the harshness of life in so much of the world. And this is where we've come to a whole new crisis of conscience, really, about what it means to be Christians in a world of this widening income gap, this widening gulf between the rich and the poor. What it means to be Christians, many of whom, in fact, when we start working through the religious demography, belong to the rich world. It's one of those embarrassments, in a way, that when we follow a gospel which starts with blessed are the poor, that so many of us are in fact rich, at least physically rich and materially rich, even though we may, some of us, be spiritually poor. And the poor world of this planet is very often the world of people of other faiths. It's those neighbours who so outnumber us, who are Hindus or adherents of traditional religions or Buddhists, and they are the ones without the water, they are the ones without the food in their belly. Theirs are the children who die. Of course, there are many poor Christians as well, and particularly when we think of Latin America, we know that at least there are Christianized people there who are living at the very bottom of the pit. But one of the things we had to face up to was, is it really fair to ask somebody who doesn't have water to drink and doesn't have enough water to be hygienic and therefore get sucked into this cycle of sickness and eventually mortality? People who haven't enough to eat, how easy is it for us to expect them to make the free choice of response to the gospel, and to really believe as readily as we can believe that God is good and God is sustaining them when they don't know where the next meal is going to come from or where the next water is to come from? And so the image of the well, the place where we have to dig to get the water, and where we have to draw to get the water, and then from which we have to conserve the water and share the water out, becomes a very important image. If you go to a country like Pakistan, which depends on irrigation, water taken from the river or from the canals, but then carried further and further away to where people are trying to reclaim land or hold on to land as a result of irrigation, you realize that some of the worst quarrels that arise, and most of the murders that take place, arise because of water. Because people have been using the well not at the time that way they were allocated to use it, or they've taken more than their fair share of water at a time when people know that water has to be shared very scrupulously. So wells become also this bone of contention in some societies. And that's where we've come more and more to realize that one of the great ethical implications of being a Christian is that we have to learn to share. We have to learn to share our resources. But not sharing in the unilateral sense of the rich having something to give to the poor. Sharing.
But the rich took it from the poor to begin with.
They took it from the poor to begin with.
They're only giving it back.
They
this
received
is something,
it.
This is something that you will please pardon me.
Sure, no,
but the first world is so rich because you're sucking the third world since four centuries.
It has to be said.
That's it. I'm sorry to say it, but that's it. And the same happens with the in the Eastern countries. The Soviet Union sucks East Germany as much as it can.
None of us have a clear record on this, and what we have to understand by the idea of sharing is really a two-way traffic. We have to see that, as you say, what we maybe give back as a rather pathetic tithe is in fact a giving back. But what we also have to see, I think, is that those who are poor very often, without wanting to romanticize or condescend, they do have very real achievements, graces, that need to be honored and need to be perceived. And the thing that has gone wrong with so much of inter-church aid in the past is that we've seen it just as this one direction, rich to poor. And we haven't seen that, to be honest, it has to be a genuine two-way sharing. That we need each other. We need, as many of us in this room at least, as rich people, to get our values straight, to get our stewardship right. Of course, we have been given many talents, and these talents have to be used, not just buried in the earth, not just kept for ourselves, to be passed on as an inheritance from one to another, but they have to be risked, they have to be expended. And God is going to be glad if we do use our riches wisely and generously. At the same time, there are those who give quietly, anonymously, very small quantities, the widow's mite of the gospel story, what we heard in Vespers last night, the self-sacrifice of a Paulina in Tanzania. And as was said again to us last night so beautifully, we have, if we are going to really realize an ecumenical family, the sense of the global village, we have to realize that there are just as many things to learn and to be received, even from the poorest of the poor, as in the reverse direction. There was a whole Vancouver focus on what was called sharing life in community. It was coupled, incidentally, with the idea of healing, because sharing and healing go together. Very often we know that a healing ministry has to be a ministry not just of an expert individual to an individual sufferer, but it has to be the caring of a whole community, a sustaining by a community of the sick. But when we come in the Vancouver reflections to healing and sharing life in community, we get some good, clear statements, some of which I will quote briefly to you. In the global village, Christians need to visit each other more often. The churches could do much to foster sharing and exchange. The visiting, incidentally, doesn't have to be physical visiting. It has to be the visiting of informing ourselves about other people's lives, praying more deliberately and purposefully for other people in whatever condition they are. We welcome and encourage new forms of multilateral sharing of personnel in world mission. Mission no longer understood simply as the rich churches sending their experts to the poor churches, but the receiving in two-way traffic of the different cultural gifts and cultural graces across the world, sharing in a healing and sharing ministry of the churches. Churches in rich countries have to learn how to receive from materially poor churches, just as the same as the latter have to learn how to be givers. New models of sharing material resources must be sought donor-receiver type of relationship must give way to relationships which facilitate the sharing of decisions, a sharing of decision-making and sharing of power. This implies that priorities for the allocation of funds be set by local communities, that more funds be made available without specific designation. Bilateral and confessional patterns of sharing have to be challenged so that the churches may grow towards greater ecumenical sharing on local, regional, and international levels. Now that is a lot of ecumenical verbiage in a way, I'm sorry, but let's see what's behind the words. Some of it are some very ugly realities. But when we have taken the decision that we know best where the money needs to be given, quite unintentionally, we've sometimes used our riches almost as a corrupting force in a given local situation. When we have used our riches to favour a particular group in society, maybe Methodists giving to Methodists or Lutherans giving to Lutherans, unintentionally maybe, we have repeated patterns of Christian division, Christian jealousy, Christian fragmentation in countries where maybe there was a greater potential for church unity. And then suddenly the money that's come in has been not a cause of blessing, but a threat of corruption. And we have to be very self-critical about this. We have to see too that even when the money is being transmitted ecumenically, which many people think is the wisest way to do it, where the churches together take a decision what their priorities are, and not only what their priorities are, but what the surrounding society's priorities are, so that the money may not be spent on Christians in the first instance, it may be spent on Buddhists, or it may be spent on Jews, or it may be spent on Muslims. When we take those decisions, even ecumenically, we have to be careful. Because so often in a world of poverty, the money that comes in the name of the churches, could be misused. It could be used as a sort of false inducement. Become a Christian and get a scholarship. Or even more basically, take a Christian name and be sure that you'll be there for a handout from the soup kitchen.
On a practical level, yes. It can be misunderstood totally. I'm thinking of I know the sister of a missionary in Cameroon who's recently died there. She was very well appreciated because she did, as you say, she shared her faith and she took from them things that they could teach her and learned quite a bit while she was there. A memorial fund has been set up in her name for the Sudan mission. One of the things her sister pointed out is that it's to be used for scholarships for the students, and some of the students are female. And in that society, money given to a female is always for prostitution purposes or to your mistress. And that could be misunderstood if not applied properly. So rather than give it to individual students, it would be given to the school for use in particular cases. That will not be as misunderstood. So if you take decisions without consulting with those people to whom you're giving,
you could create
totally wrong,
devastating, disruptive impressions with the best will in the world. I don't know how you see this sharing issue and how far you see it both affecting your personal giving but also your church's givings, and what we can do to try to clean up a situation of chaotic giving, really. Giving which, so far, for all the attempts to share decisions and to make sure that the receivers have as much say in it as the donors have in it, very often break down. So that in the last resort, people like to know, to choose their charity, and to be thanked for their giving and all this sort of thing. The idea of really all of us being anonymous givers, of slipping in our mite without being noticed, is undermined again and again by people's desire to have their name inscribed upon those who have in fact paid $500 a plate, or those who have in fact designated a particular bed in a ward. I'm not knocking that, but
those
you know,
who
you
view
have
that
to
their
do
money
work.
Goes for corruption rather than for what they meant it to go to.
Yeah. But there's a problem there that needs to be faced in the home. Giving, the giver has a certain authority, is an authority figure. My mother is 85 years old, and she still complains when we want to give her something. And I said, you've given us, let us give you back, but she has trouble accepting that. And if it happens in a close relationship like that, we take that feeling with us.
Yes, you're right.
I think of my grandmother at this point, when we go into the village center and see that big thing, Be Holden, I think of a word that my grandmother very often used, which was, I don't want to be beholden.
Yes,
I don't want to be beholden, either to the family or to her friends. She was an independent woman. She was a generous woman. Also very loving and caring. She longed to give. And yet sometimes she found it hard to receive. Maybe in her older age, she mellowed.
I wonder.
And yet we're all like that. Yeah. We all do have that, I think, that independent streak.
Yeah.
And I find it's something I have to try to discipline in myself. That in, and it's a very a widely reaching lesson to learn. I have to apply it to my own profession. Here I am studying the world's religions, and I could do it just from a distance. But sometimes there comes a point where I have to say, now, am I prepared to learn something from those other people? Am I prepared to learn something from Judaism?
Mm-hmm.
To learn something from, say, the spiritual disciplines of a Muslim? To learn something from the peacemaking instincts of a Hindu or a Buddhist? And one part of me, the proud part of me, doesn't want to learn. And if I think, if I want them to learn something from me, if I want them to learn something from Christ, if I want them to be open to Christ, then maybe it's catching. If we can be beholden, if we can show that none of us can do it by ourselves, if we can learn what it really means to be interdependent, to need each other, then I think that is one of these models of unity which the church can give as a gift to the world. That if the church can be a place where Christians really need each other, and each feels incomplete without the other, incomplete without the other denominations, incomplete without the other races, incomplete without people of the other sex, and so on, if we have this sense of really being a church where both Jew and Greek, both bond and free, both male and female, are all one in Jesus Christ, then I think we shall have something to share with the world. Perhaps I should just shift on to the final stage, where, having thought about the need to be a church in the service of the world, receiving other people's water, but also sharing water at the well, I come to that final image where water is most needed, the image of the desert. And yet the desert, that, as we all know, has got these extraordinary hidden resources. The water that comes sometimes as moisture, as dew, rather as the manna came into the desert to feed the children of Israel. The deserts, as some of you know on this continent, at certain times of the year, suddenly blossom in an amazing way with sheets of flowers.
Our country too.
The deserts also of the soul, the deserts of the spirit, that can be refreshed, the deserts that can be watered, maybe by the water of baptism, maybe by the cup of cold water given in sharing by another human being. So that suddenly a life that was lonely and rejected and despised takes on dignity and feels accepted. Or somebody out in the desert with a dusty feet, whose feet are washed by a Christ figure and becomes accepted and becomes a person again. The desert imagery, which goes back to Abraham, but also, I say, has been seen to be a feature of the present stage of the ecumenical movement, an ecumenical movement that has ventured forth from the securities of the Christian family and is now taking risks out in the world, out in the desert, feeling the heat of the sun, feeling the thirst, and yet finding that sometimes really out in that desert miracles can happen. Let me give a concrete image. The church in Haiti, one of the poorest places in this hemisphere, with some of the most appalling political and judicial corruption and exploitation. Arnold's reminded us about what transnational corporations can do. Haiti is a classic example of a country that has been, although nominally independent for nearly 200 years,
the first Latin American country
to have its independence, it is in fact economically totally in the clutches of certain international multinationals, not just American multinationals, European multinationals, and the rich bourgeoisie the world over have their shares in these multinationals. It isn't a question of knocking one continent against another. But in Haiti, the small Methodist church there, where incidentally our General Secretary Philip Potter was pastor to begin with, and where he learned what it means to be in a desert, to be in a wilderness, but where he also saw the faith of the people in that wilderness. I'm thinking both of a physical example and a spiritual example. A physical example where the church has brought in simple techniques of water cultivation and helped people to grow tomatoes and grow papayas and grow avocados on the desert ground using solar panels to remove most of the salt, but not all of the salt, from the water, and then have a simple hydroponic experiment, but more than an experiment, an achievement, to feed the local people and even to produce a cash crop for them. But also the spiritual example of how sometimes even in that desperately poor region, a particular Christian example can shine through. And Philip Potter has often said to us that his whole ecumenical ministry, which has been one of such distinction, has often taken its first impulse from the life of faith of some of those people struggling in extreme poverty in the desert areas of Western Haiti. The desert is, of course, a place where people can be left to die, and where all that will be left will be the bleached bones. And yet, once again, the Bible will help us that the bones in the desert can have life given to them. We never go beyond, I think, a claim on Christian hope. And that's why I think it was so good for our forum last night to focus on hope. And even if the ecumenical movement is going through tough periods of opposition, through caricatures, through harsh, dry moments, I believe that the living water is there, beneath the surface, perhaps waiting to be released by a well. The living water is there in the lives of people who go into the desert and suffer in the desert, but share in the desert. So it won't all be the excitement of Vancouver. It won't all be the worship tent and the singing and the music. It won't all be the feasting together, the Eucharistic feasting, the agape feasting, and just the good, warm hospitality and rich nourishment of North American living. A lot of our brothers and sisters have already returned to their deserts, to the battlefields of today's world. But as they've gone, we hope that they've taken nourishment with them. And we hope that we who have been privileged to listen to their testimonies, the testimonies of the cancer-ridden woman from the Pacific Islands, or the testimony of the woman who goes back to the fighting in Beirut, or the testimony of the people who go back to Siberia or to the Baltic states, we hope that their commitment to continue to share cups of cold water, to continue to wash feet, to continue to irrigate desert places will be an inspiration to us. 2 or 3 minutes left before the lunch bell goes. I don't know whether any of you have ideas on deserts that you want to share.
I have one. I think that the ecumenical movement is out in a desert. You see by the criticism of many of the press, people who get so much excited about statements which have political content and forget about the wonderful water that is just in a creek going by them. They only see these shrubs and so forth and don't see that wonderful water, which is the sharing of the life of the world that we all have. And you said so well, John, about the poor and needy. Same we have in Brazil, in Latin America. I sometimes get so amazed at my own people. When the team visit of the WCC came to Brazil, they came also to Curitiba. We arranged a lot of meetings. Then we had also one in Curitiba, a city of 1 million people, in one settled church. Only a few people appeared. On the same day in the afternoon, at 2 p.m. afternoon, a very unusual hour, in the middle of the week, in a rural area, we had a full church of poor people. The meeting had to be at 2 o'clock with service in the church, because at 4 they should be home to ordain their cows. Mm-hmm. You see, and I thought I was so afraid of that meeting in the rural area. I thought, this will be an empty church, because everybody's going to, they have to work, either they get the milk or they don't have enough to eat, you know. They are very small farmers. And the church was full. And in the city, where you have everything, I mean, the church was empty. This, the poor people have much more faith than we.
So thank you, friends.
Thank you, John.
Right.
Yes.